Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sugandha Tandon, and I'm a research assistant at Institute of Chinese Studies, New Delhi. On behalf of ICS, I welcome you all to our first book discussion of the year on Churchill and India, Manipulation or Betrayal, authored by Kishan S. Rana. I would like to commence today's session with a line taken from book's foreword by Kiran Doshi, and I quote, "Most British people today regard Winston Churchill as one of the greatest leaders of the last century. Most Indians would put him on the short list of its villains. The truth, as usual, lies somewhere in between. The intriguing question is exactly where in between." Granting credence to the depth of this question, Ambassador Rana's book, grounded in meticulous research, seeks to bring forth answers which have hitherto not seen the light of day. The book is a result of vigorous pursuit and study of documents scattered across various archives and libraries, to name a few: the Churchill Archives, the Churchill College, British Archives London, Brooklands and Wilson Center, Washington, D.C., and of course, the Nehru Memorial Library and Archives, New Delhi. The author traces the trajectory of Churchill's path from a young cavalry subaltern to a feisty politician and his rise to the upper echelons of British politics. The author and speaker for today is Ambassador Kishan S. Rana, who has been associated with the Indian Foreign Service for over 35 years. He has served as the ambassador and high commissioner to Algeria, Czechoslovakia, Kenya, Mauritius, and Germany. He has also been posted as consul general in San Francisco, and he is an emeritus fellow at Institute of Chinese Studies. Our chair and discussant for today is Mr. Ravi Bhutalingam, an honorary fellow at Institute of Chinese Studies, founder and chairman of Manas Advisory Gurgaon. He has also served as an independent director and member in advisory councils on several corporate boards. Furthermore, he has written extensively about the application of science and psychology towards enhancing the level of understanding between India and China. Before I hand over to the chair, I would like to apprise you all of a few housekeeping rules. All participants will be muted throughout the session. Questions can only be posted in the chat box throughout the session. I would like to remind you all that we won't be taking questions with the raised hand options in today's Wednesday seminar. That's all. I will pause and now I'll hand over the floor to the chair, Mr. Bhutalingam, to take the proceedings forward. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Sugandha. Welcome to everyone at this Wednesday seminar, and greetings to you, Kishan. This is going to be a seminar with a difference. The format is slightly different, starting with a short exposition by Ambassador Kishan Rana on his book, some questions and answers between myself and him, and then an open discussion. But the point of real difference is that we wished this to be an in-depth discussion of a very interesting and novel work, which Ambassador Rana has produced. Sugandha has given a brief introduction, but Kishan is not only an old friend, but a man of many, many parts, a distinguished ambassador and member of the Indian Foreign Service, a prolific author. This book, which is right here, is his 12th book. The previous 11 were on subjects related to diplomacy and foreign policy. This is a departure, a significant departure into the field of biography and history. Thirdly, he is a prolific writer and columnist in newspapers and journals. And apart from all that, he spends time on photography, traveling, writing book reviews. The overall energy level is something which is exemplary, if I may say so, to people of any age. So having said that, let me now turn to today's issue, the book discussion. And this is going to be formatted in three specific parts. First, I'm going to ask Ambassador Rana to tell us in brief what the book is all about. Let's say over a period of 10 minutes or so. And in particular, I would like him to answer two questions. Why he wrote the book and what is the target audience for this book? So after that first 10 minutes, we will have a question and answer session where I will pose some questions and we will have a dialogue in a kind of Socratic sense. And after that, it will be open to the house and we can ask questions in the format that Sugandha has just mentioned. And I'm sure we will have a very lively discussion. So having said that, Kishan, now may I hand over to you for the next 10 minutes to tell us why and what the book is all about.
Thank you very much, Ravi. My deep thanks also to the Institute of Chinese Studies and to the young friends who are increasingly managing the affairs at ICS, Sugandha and all the others, right up to Rija, who is the assistant director, and of course, many old friends who are present in the chat, and those who are perhaps also in the live stream audience. Okay, why the book? On a first visit to Churchill College and to Churchill Archives, I was enormously impressed by the archives and the thoroughly organized manner in which they operate. I think the way a modern archives functions is really a subject that is worth some detailed examination in India, because I fear we simply don't do that anywhere in India. So I found that while more than 2,000 books have been written on Churchill, mostly biographies, not a single book examines what is really a powerful but small element in his life, the connection with India. And the book really explores that fairly completely, I think. But I'm sure there are many missing elements, and we'll come to that. Second question, who's the audience? Kiran Doshi, who's a very old friend, the author of a splendid book, Jinnah Often Came to Our House, which is a novel, but based on history. Kiran told me much after the book was sent into production, he said, you are not writing this book for anyone present today. You are writing this book for the audience that is yet to be born. And I was very touched, frankly, when I heard that. Because, I mean, that's the thing about a book. Regardless of digitization and everything else, the physical book is indoors. Already we see that e-books are fine, but also a pain in the neck. There is nothing more satisfying than a physical book. And a book will rest on a bookshelf, unread for 15, 20 years, and somebody will pick it up. And God knows another wave of interest will reemerge vis-a-vis that work. Okay. Let me speak only to one dimension of the book, which is, I think, quite important, and that is the Churchill-Jinnah connection. After the first roundtable conference, Jinnah stayed on in London for 4 years and practiced at the Privy Council and at the British High Court, drove around in the Bentley, chauffeured, of course, and collected some 70 Savile Row suits. Well, that's not bad, you know. I mean, for anybody who is into good clothes, 70 Savile Row suits is a pretty nice number to have. The reason Jinnah stayed back, he wrote to his sister that the scene of action has shifted to Britain. Now, this was also the time when Winston Churchill, from 1929 to 1935, was engaged in a heroic but totally futile struggle against what became the Government of India Independence Act of 1935. It is inconceivable that Jinnah and Churchill did not meet, did not begin their collaboration at the time. But we have zero evidence of that. Why is that? You know, Churchill always had a huge concern over his public image. And in 1946, in December, when Jinnah and Churchill met for the last time, and Jinnah was invited to Churchill's lovely country home, which is called Chartwell, and which is today a great museum on the life of this great man. And Churchill was a great man, but a great man with a great man's failures, which are also quite often as great as their other greatness. They met for lunch at Churchill's country house. And Jinnah then invited Churchill to have lunch with him in London. And Churchill declined. He said, we should not be seen together. He understood the politics of it. Churchill was always conscious of politics. Now, Gandhiji attended the second roundtable conference. And he sent a private message to Churchill through Churchill's son, who was a young journalist at that time, saying that he wanted to meet him. And Churchill did not reply. 4 years later, when Gandhiji sent two emissaries to meet Churchill, G.D. Birla, the great Ganjam Das Birla, the founder of the Birla dynasty, and Mirabai, who was the daughter of a British admiral, and her name was Mary Slade, and she took the name of Mirabai. Mirabai said, you know, Gandhiji had wanted to meet you. Why didn't you meet him? And Churchill replied in a very British way. He said, it would not have done to be seen in public. Now, what he meant was, it was politically imprudent for him to be seen in public with Gandhiji. So, without any hard proof, I strongly contend that the connection between Jinnah and Churchill commenced in 1932. Oh, by the way, Jinnah tried also to get into the British Parliament through a by-election. He first tried with the Conservative Party, and then he tried with the Labour Party. He was so desperate to get in to the British Parliament to find a platform for his views. And he couldn't get a ticket. Now, that again shows how Jinnah's mind worked in terms of finding a large stage on which he could pursue his Pakistan project. And you know, the Pakistan project, the word Pakistan entered our political conversations only after the Lahore meeting of the Muslim League in March 1940, exactly. Okay. During my research, I dug out a letter from the British National Archives written by Jinnah to Churchill on the 2nd of January 1941. It's the first hard piece of evidence that we have of their communications. And let me say, that letter does not exist in the Churchill archives, because Churchill archives did not receive the documents which were supposedly to be sent all the documents were supposed to be sent to the Churchill archives by Churchill. Churchill was very much alive at the time when the Churchill archives was established. A whole collection of papers relating to that correspondence simply disappeared. In August 1946, when Churchill was out of power, his private secretary, again, this is something I dug out from the archives. Nobody else had bothered to find it. I found a letter written by Churchill's private secretary. Mind you, he was then leader of the opposition, didn't have all the prime ministerial privileges, saying that I'm sending the file of correspondence between Mr. Churchill and Mr. Jinnah. And a month later, the file was returned by Rab Butler's secretary. Butler was, in effect, the number two man in the Conservative Party at that time. Now, where's that file? It doesn't exist. It's disappeared somewhere. Now, somebody told me, there never was a file. It was just a few scraps of letters. This is utter nonsense. Okay. I am going to overstep the time limit by a few minutes, Ravi, but I want to complete this story.
Please.
The connection between Churchill and Jinnah is a hugely understudied subject. Is there a smoking gun? No. There is no smoking gun that we can find. But we find wisps of smoke. Going back to that letter of 2nd January 1941, that letter has the flavor of conversation between two people who know each other quite well. It is absolutely not the first letter by the head of the Muslim League writing to the British Prime Minister. And then there are one or two other letters that survive in the period up to 45, July 45, when Churchill was still Prime Minister. After that, there are a few more letters. There is a very interesting letter in 1946 in which Jinnah apparently used some strong language to criticize the British position vis-a-vis the Muslims or the Muslim League and the Muslim demand for Pakistan. And Churchill said, it is one thing to criticize actions taken by the British government, but to attack the British would not be a wise action on your part. And finally, we have the well-documented verbal message that Churchill gave to Mountbatten in March 1947. Mountbatten took over as viceroy, I think, in January or February 47. And he turned up in London just a few weeks later, and he went to see Churchill, who was lying in bed. He was ill. And he said, you know, Jinnah is being very unreasonable. He doesn't say yes and he doesn't say no to the partition project. And he has to make up his mind. I mean, after all, this is the best deal that he can possibly get. And Churchill said, I want you to convey a verbal message to Jinnah. I want you to tell him that he is getting an opportunity which he should grasp with both hands. And the flavor of that message, the content of the message, was one of a teacher, a schoolmaster, instructing his pupil on how to behave. Again, to me, that speaks of the relationship between the two. In 1947, it was probably in June, Jinnah wrote a letter again asking for support. Mind you, Churchill was then leader of the opposition. He was no longer in government. And Churchill dictated a reply, but we don't know if that letter was actually sent or not. So these are the wisps of smoke we find. But behind this, there is a bigger reality. The bigger reality is that British strategic thinkers had decided way back in 1940 that as and when Britain is forced to leave India, it must leave behind an entity which will automatically be pro-West, an entity which will act as a bastion of Western ideas against the Soviet Union coming into the warm waters of the Arabian Sea, and give a degree of strategic control to Western countries over the oil wealth of that entire region. Now, how is that to be executed? By creating an entity which would be a Muslim state, which would be favorable to the West. And again, through a careful reading of correspondence, I found an important, and this is now a smoking gun. What is the smoking gun? A letter that Roosevelt wrote to Churchill on the 11th May 1942. It exists in the documents. The full text is available in that three-volume collection of the messages exchanged between the two leaders. And I have a bell ringing at the back. It will just keep ringing because there's nobody to pick it up to go and open the door. Okay, so please ignore that. My apologies. So in that letter, Roosevelt tells Churchill, I must give the setting. The letter is written at a time when the Cripps mission has ended. It has failed and Cripps is about to leave Delhi. And Roosevelt says, please hold back Cripps in India because I think there is a way out of the impasse that he has faced. It was too late. Cripps had actually already left India by the time the message reached Churchill. But in that message, Roosevelt makes a major disclosure. He says, you have been opposed to giving self-rule to India, but you have been quite willing to create from that entity a Muslim state. Now, this is the first hard evidence we have of a major leader, the United States president, telling Churchill that you have been willing to create a Muslim state way back in May 1942. So this is something that had already been discussed between Churchill and Roosevelt. So when was partition of India decided? As far as Britain was concerned, well before May 1942, I submit this is the first solid evidence we have, solid, irrefutable evidence we have from the American president that he and Churchill had discussed that Britain was going to create a Muslim state out of British India way back in 1942. Now, if this is not collaboration, if this is not betrayal of basic principles of governance, then what is betrayal? There are other bits of evidence and material which my book gets into, but I will stop here. My apologies, I've gone on for too long. Sorry, Ravi.
Not at all. Thank you. Thank you, Kishan, for that really fascinating excerpt and giving a flavor of the book as you have written it, which I may say the hallmark is the extensive research that you have done, the unearthing of these documents from the archives, tying one event to another, which is not easy with the some of the unavailability of the evidence. And you have been very transparent in talking about what evidence is admissible and where there is no evidence and one has to rely on wisps and fragments to piece together what might have happened, but which cannot be proven. So now, I'm not a historical scholar or a diplomat to quiz you on historical method. So I'm going to ask you a few questions from the standpoint of a layman, an interested layman, who wanders into a bookshop, sees your book, and is interested by the title, Churchill and India, goes there, leafs through the blurbs, a few pages perhaps, and then is interested enough to ask these questions. So as putting myself in that position, the first question I have is, Churchill in India is very clear, and you've explained why you chose this particular aspect, which is in fact under-researched in the general biographies. But what interests me more is the subtitle, Manipulation or Betrayal. So what you have sort of posed to the reader here is that having read this book, you have to answer a question. And that question is, was it manipulation or was it betrayal? Manipulation and betrayal of whom? Well, it has to be India, because that is the main title. So let me leave, for the time being, I'll come back to it. Let me leave manipulation aside for the moment. Because one might say manipulation is a stock in trade of any politician.
Perfect.
And Churchill was a politician. Many politicians feel that manipulation is okay if it is in a larger end and serves a larger goal and serves the oath of office and so on. But betrayal is a more serious charge. And of course, betrayal can only happen if the person who is being betrayed has reposed trust and confidence in the other person who is doing the betraying. So this gives rise to a question. Did the Indian people place trust and confidence in Winston Churchill, who, as you say, betrayed India? Or indeed, did the Indian leaders at that time, who were, of course, not, India was not independent, but Nehru, Gandhi, Jinnah, Ambedkar, did they place trust in Churchill? And you spent time on Jinnah, and I think there is a, you made a very good point there. So if they did not place their wholehearted trust in Churchill, or India did not, then can you really say it was betrayal? So this is my first question.
Thank you very much, Ravi. That's an excellent question, because it's a question that directly connects with what I tried to say about Churchill and Jinnah. How can you betray something when you have never shared those values? My response, sir, would be that it was a betrayal of basic, intrinsic human values. And these are the same human values that British colonial rulers frequently referred to when they said that they were working for the welfare of the people of India, that they were, in fact, the custodians of Indian interests. I think the best piece of evidence I can give you is really the Churchill-Gandhi connection. I already mentioned that in the 30s, Gandhiji tried first to meet Churchill and then sent two emissaries. That didn't work. Churchill gave them these two emissaries. He gave them lovely conversations, but said nothing of any real substance. Although, mind you, he said, I have great admiration for Mr. Gandhi, for the work that he has done for the depressed classes, etc., etc. After Gandhi Ji was released from prison in March 1944, he had been in jail for 1 year and 6-7 months, perhaps, from the 8th of August 1942 till March 1944. Can you imagine the sense of personal injury that Gandhiji would have felt? He had tried to reach out to Churchill. He was the only Indian leader who reached out to Churchill in the 30s. Nehru did not lift a finger. Maybe Nehru thought that Churchill was beyond the pale, and maybe he was right. But putting that aside, Gandhiji tried. In 1941, when Churchill became Prime Minister, and this is again not very widely known, but it's known, he sent a British clergywoman to meet the Secretary of State for India, Amery, with a message saying that Gandhiji wished, that Gandhiji wanted to convey his good wishes to the British government, etc. And he really for the peace, which is more fulsome than what I have summarized. And Amery politely listened to her and said virtually nothing. And when this lady was leaving, she said, "Do you have any message for Gandhiji?" And Amery said, "Please give him my good wishes." And they had two conversations and nothing happened. Now, and then Churchill locked up Gandhiji. He called him by all manner of names, which I go into in my book. So Gandhiji wrote a letter to Churchill on the 17th July, 1944. 17th July. He's been released from prison, maybe 2-3 months. He's been a free man, relatively speaking, after the death of Kasturba and after his survival from that final major fast that he undertook in prison when he came close to dying. And Churchill sent messages to Viceroy saying, "Isn't Gandhi dead yet?" I mean, that was the degree of Churchill's humanity. And in that message, it's a message of 7 lines, literally 7 lines. Churchill says, and Gandhiji said, "You have called me the naked fakir." And he said, "I write to you in that capacity, as a naked fakir." And he says, "I ask you to trust and use me for the sake of my people and your people, and through them, the people of the world." So what did Gandhiji ask for? Gandhiji said, "Trust and use me." And you know what happened? 2 months after the message was sent, through the office of the Viceroy, Gandhiji's secretary staff contacted the office of the Viceroy. And they said, "We've never received the letter." And I mean, this is not believable. And Gandhiji then proceeded to make the letter public. Now, this was indecency, not just political indecency, but human indecency. Because the same Churchill who had shed crocodile tears to Gandhiji's emissaries about the plight of the depressed classes, that same Churchill turned down the demands made by British India, by Linlithgow and his staff, his officials, for relief supplies for the famine that had affected East India from 42 all the way till 44. And what was Churchill's reply? Churchill said that the food grains are needed for the Greeks. The Greeks are a sturdy people and they need their food. The Bengalis are half-starved anyway. These are Churchill's words, nobody else's words. Now, this was a betrayal of humanity. This was a betrayal of the implicit foundation of the British Empire, that it would work for some aspects of the welfare of the colonized people. Surely, if Churchill trampled upon all those notions, he was betraying not just the people of India, he was betraying even the principles on which Victorians operated, where there was a degree of humanity. And I'm afraid there was so little humanity in Churchill's actions. Thank you.
Thank you, Kishan. That is indeed a very powerful answer that you have given on the subject of betrayal. Because I think what you have, the dimension you have given it, is not just betrayal of an oath of office, in this case, or an oath of office to the crown and the king emperor, but a betrayal of larger human values as such. And I feel that this message will resound well in the present generations across the world, including Britain, where there is a questioning of imperial values. You have the Rhodes Must Fall movement and others who are looking at British imperialism and colonialism in a new light. And it prompts me to suggest that maybe your book should be promoted more strongly in Britain and what Churchill called the English-speaking peoples, even more than in India. But
Ravi, I'm sorry to interrupt. I hope very much that my publisher, Rutledge, are listening to this. I will certainly send them a recording, because I have to say truthfully that the book promotion carried out by my publisher so far outside of India has not been very far from zero.
No, your argument right now is a very, very strong argument for doing just that, to promote it in those countries, which are ripe, I would say, for re-examination, because as you know, Germany recently has expressed its sorrow to Namibia and Southwest Africa.
Yes.
So has Belgium. You have something in the end of the book which talks about apology and so on. I won't get diverted into that.
Yes.
But this was just by the way. But I want to come back to this question of manipulation or betrayal. You have covered the betrayal aspect quite very thoroughly. I want to now talk of manipulation. And you mentioned Jinnah, but as you said in different parts of the book, Churchill was quite strongly engaged in the Indian part of his affairs, though it was not anywhere near a complete part of his interest. But he was in touch with many, many people. Now, the question on manipulation I want to ask you is the manipulator totally the bad guy? And is the manipulatee a completely innocent, helpless person? Is there not some congruence of thought? Does the manipulator not pick on the manipulatee because he or she feels that there may be a receptivity to this line of thought? And Churchill did so, as you said, with Jinnah, but he engaged others as well. In some cases, he did not succeed. Like Ambedkar, as you pointed out, Ambedkar was an early arguer for the separation of electorates. He wanted a separate electorate for the Dalits. But he could not achieve that because Gandhi and Ambedkar came to the Pune Pact. But many years later, in 1946, Ambedkar writes back to Churchill asking for this very thing, because Churchill was out of office at that time. So my point is, the Indian leadership at that point, whether Nehru, whether Ambedkar, whether Jinnah, were not totally on one thought. They had differences between them. And Churchill exploited these differences, and he would say, in the interests of the King Emperor and the Empire, to the greater good of Britain and to the greater good, as he thought it, of India. You pointed to the geopolitical context and so on. So, is the manipulation totally one way or the one-sided? Is there not a what one might call a circumstantial evidence on the other side as well?
Okay, Ravi. That's very interesting. The manipulatee, as you say, was, in my eyes, and I don't know everything, I'm only presenting my views for what they are worth. Please tear these views to shreds and come up with your own interpretation, and nothing would give me greater joy. I think the manipulatee was complicit, in my eyes, in the sense that we as Indians did not fully understand our own self-interest. Several examples can be given. Why did the Congress chief ministers walk out of the provinces, the 8 provinces which were being run by the Congress party as soon as war was declared? Did they not understand? Did they not stop to think that this knee-jerk reaction of quitting the provincial government played into the hands of the British, that they were manipulated into acting in a completely short-sighted fashion? Second point, was the Quit India movement of August 1942, was it really such a brilliant idea? And even if it was a brilliant idea, when you saw that the British were unmoved, should not the Indian leaders have started a process of making an opening to Britain in terms of dialogue? Because what was the result? The result was that for nearly 2.5 years, from August 42 to about April, May 44, when Nehru, Patel, Maulana Azad were released, there was zero dialogue between the national movement and the British. And mind you, the differences between different elements of the national movement, Subhashchandra Bose, Ambedkar, and many others, those were also ever present. But that's politics. I mean, you can't expect one single unified autocratic movement to triumph at all times. So in that sense also, we let ourselves be manipulated, or let's say we opened ourselves to manipulation. Did nobody stop to ask, while we are doing this, while we are locked up in prison, not allowed even to communicate with one another, Jinnah is sitting there merrily making the best of it and solidifying his position. Another element of manipulation, Churchill sent out indirect signals to British officials in India that Jinnah was Britain's man. Now, how these signals were sent, I don't know. I think other researchers will have to study and examine and see if I'm pursuing a false trail or whether there were, in fact, signals. But we know, for example, from the British governor of Punjab, who said in 1945, at the time of the Simla conference, he said, Jinnah's claim to represent all of Punjab is false. But see, Jinnah, in that letter, you remember I mentioned the letter of 2nd January 1941? In that letter, Jinnah produced a wonderful big, big lie. He said 90% of Muslims support the Muslim League. And this is the same guy who in the provincial elections of 1947, in those separate communal electorates, had only got 24% of the total vote of the Muslims. How did 24 become 90? It was nonsense. But Churchill lapped it up. And he said, wonderful. And he sent that letter, by the way, to Roosevelt to say, you see, this is the trump card that I am playing in India. I mean, you know, again, I have to get into lots of tiny details, which I can't do in this kind of a conversation. But believe me, there is ample evidence also to show manipulation at different levels. But I think, Ravi, we are perhaps at a point where we must bring others into the conversation. I don't want to appear to be a single voice holding forth on everything. I will now attempt to give very brief replies if there are any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Kishan. There are no questions as yet, so I'll give people a few more minutes to post their questions. But meanwhile, I have one more question to ask you. You state at various parts in the book that Churchill's views of India in the 1920s, when he was very vociferous about his views and his opposition to the nationalist movement and where, in fact, Britain was going in its negotiations at that time with Nehru and Gandhi. You mentioned that Churchill's views were misconceived and he was very much out of touch even with the current of the times in his own party and therefore sort of drew the hostility of his own party.
Yes.
But I would like to suggest to you that he was very much in touch with what was happening in the world in contemporary times at that time. Mm-hmm. Let me explain that at the closing years of the First World War, Churchill was involved in the Dardanelles and the Gallipoli campaigns, and the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, was reaching its end. And when the Ottoman Empire was reaching its end, Britain and France colluded, and we have the Lawrence of Arabia story and so on, they colluded in the collapse of the Turkish Empire, the fomenting of revolt by the Arab chieftains, including Prince Abdullah. And to cut a long story short, in the next 4 or 5 years before the mid-20s, the Ottoman Empire collapsed. The chieftains in Arabia gained their country, which we now call Saudi Arabia. Britain got the protectorates of Jordan and Palestine. France got Syria and Lebanon. The other parts like Aden and the Gulf remained colonies of Britain. In fact, what happened to Arabia and the Turkish Empire was exactly what Churchill now thought would be the formula for India post the empire. That is, break it up into many units, let them be loyal to the West, We have strategic control, the naval ports, the oil, energy, and so on. And that is the formula for the retreat of the empire. This was playing out in the 1920s. So it was very realistic. It was grounded on something that had happened. So can you blame Churchill for saying, look, this is the way forward. Don't negotiate with these people. This is what you should do.
Ravi, that's a very interesting point of view. Certainly, the analogy of the Middle East, as it's called, or West Asia, as I would prefer to call it, is relevant in the case of British India. But then, remember, the huge difference between West Asia and British India was that there was a national movement for self-governance, self-rule that had been underway since the turn of the century, and which was not the case in the region that you refer to. Supposing Churchill had won the election of August 1945, what would have happened? This is a very interesting question. I've not done any research on this. Perhaps there are books that have addressed this question. And it may well be that Churchill would then have worked for a balkanization of British India into separate entities which would squabble among themselves and leave themselves completely vulnerable to external manipulation, as has happened in West Asia. And I think that's a very interesting perspective that deserves examination. But, you know, I was not addressing that huge global canvas that you have sketched. I was addressing only, maybe this is a limitation of my own thinking, I was addressing only the events in South Asia. And in South Asia, for a variety of reasons, including evolution, political evolution in British India, there was already a glacial move towards some kind of self-government for India. And that is the movement that Churchill strongly opposed. That was not the case in West Asia. So, what Churchill betrayed there, in a sense, was a national sense of Britain. Don't forget that it was the Labour Party which won the election in the late 20s, when Churchill was thrown out of office. And as a member of the Tory Party which was in the opposition, the Tory Party from the opposition supported the glacial movement towards provincial governance in India being given to Indians. So Churchill was not simply opposing India or Indian interests. He was also opposing what was the majority political view in his own country. You know, one element that is underexamined is the role played by Catherine Mayo's book, Mother India, in the framing of Churchill's thinking. That book, in a sense, gave a vocabulary to Churchill with which he then went on to attack Gandhiji and the entire national movement. He talked constantly of the depressed classes. But I give you the example of the Bengal famine. Who were the first victims of the Great Indian Famine? The depressed classes. The same depressed classes in whose name rivers of crocodile tears ran down Churchill's face when he met Mirabain and Ghanshyam Das Birla. And this was nonsense. The man was completely bogus. He was simply playing politics. So if Churchill had somehow come to power in August 1945, if Labour had not won, God forbid, we don't know what might have happened. There is one other element I will throw into the pot, which is the impact of the wars, of the two great wars on the colonized people. Well, here is a subject that really deserves deep study. The national movement post-1918 thrived on the fact that 2.5 million soldiers had returned from England and from the Flanders and all these exotic places, Mesopotamia, where my Nanaji fought and won the battlefield commission and went on to become the commander of the Bhavnagar state forces. From a Sowar, this young man was catapulted into the position even of ADC to the Viceroy, if you please. So that was transformative. In a similar way, World War II was also going to be transformative. It was transformative in the impact on the people of the subcontinent of British India. And I think between these two great massive changes in people's thinking, the returned soldiers and the stories they brought back, I don't think colonialism could have survived. So my guess is that if Churchill had come to power in August 1945, we would have seen a massive bloodbath across British India opposing British rule. And it would have been, in a sense, a return to some of the ideals and thinking of Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose. I think Gandhiji would not have been vindicated even remotely, because the only response that could have been given to British repression a la Churchill would have been fierce, militant resistance. But this is all in the realm of speculation. The cards were played differently. Labour came to power, and Labour acted in a fashion which was both decisive and hasty. But what could Attlee do? Attlee also, there had been no planning, there had been no thinking about what might happen in British India. This is really the biggest charge I lay at the door of Winston Churchill. August 1942 to mid-1945 were the wasted years when the planning for an exit of Britain from British India could have been planned, could have been worked out, and a partition and the partition formula could have also taken some kind of shape. Instead, we had a period of what? 13, 14, 15 months in which the entire sea change in what was British India was rammed through, and two major entities emerged in such a fashion that a second partition of that former British India territory was built into the formula by the two-wing Pakistan. And that was the second partition of India. We don't even talk about this very much. But in fact, the Bangladesh War is a child of the partition and the partition formula. Do we not stop to think, how could you have a country in two parts, not separated by geography, separated in minds, separated in culture, language, ethos, ways of thinking and living? How could this ever be melded together in one single political entity? I mean, this is a question that is perhaps not asked often enough. I don't know. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kishan. I had a last question, but I'm going to hold that question for now and ask it of you right at the very end, because there are some questions now in the chat box.
Thank you.
I'm going to move to the chat box and read out those questions to you. The first question is from Professor Manoranjan Mohanty, and he says, to what extent, according to you, was Churchill a powerful leader steering history, and to what extent was he a historical phenomenon? And he goes on to add, Bengal famine from 1943 saw what you rightly call Churchill's betrayal of humanity. In the 19th century, famines as well as the British policy was no different. In the case of the Orissa famine of 1866, diversion of rice to Burma and elsewhere was the main reason for almost a million deaths. That's his question.
Well, I really don't have a cogent answer that I can supply to this. Famines had taken place earlier, and I think it was the congruence of the war and the consequences of the war that made the 42-44 famine into such a big dramatic event in which anywhere from 4 to 6 million lives were lost, if we count also the people who died in Assam, Bihar, and in Odisha. But I can't really respond to the question of whether Churchill was responsible for all this, or whether it was a built-in failure of British colonialism. This is for bigger, major historians to answer. But I would pose a question to Manu, a counter question. Why does he think that the famine has received so little attention from Indian scholars? Why is it that standard textbooks in India say so little about the famine? Thank you.
The next question, Kishan, is from Sugandha. And she says, some time ago, I had read in Arthur Herman's book on Gandhi and Churchill that these two leaders had met once in London in 1906, which Guha has also highlighted. I'm aware of the view Churchill had with regard to Gandhi. I just wanted to ask if this meeting had any kind of impact on Churchill's viewpoint with respect to Gandhi.
Thank you for bringing up an interesting factoid. In fact, Churchill had no recollection of that meeting. Gandhiji remembered it, but Churchill did not. And, you know, it was all about the question of how the South African government was treating the Indians vis-a-vis the European settlers and the native Africans. It did not have any impact, really, on the real thinking of either, except that Gandhiji retained an impression of that meeting, and he felt that Churchill was actually a fairly reasonable man, and that's what he was in those days. I would commend for your attention Churchill's book, Africa Safari, the monumental journey that he took, partly on foot, partly on horseback, from Lake Victoria right up to the meeting point of the Blue and the White Nile. It was an adventurous journey. And he has depicted that with wry wit and with humor, which again was one of Churchill's hallmarks. You know, Churchill loved these play on words. And during that voyage, when he was asked in Nairobi, how is your Africa safari going, Mr. Churchill? And Churchill, without batting an eyelid, replied, So fari, so goody. I mean, look at the man's ability to play with words. Incidentally, Churchill, in his sentences, almost always used four adjectives. And this is interesting. Most people use three, and they think three is a good number. It was a Churchillian fashion to produce a four-adjective, punchy sentence. And it was while in India that Churchill wrote a brilliant essay on, in a sense, his own, how he would enter and approach politics. And it's called On Rhetoric. There are excerpts from that essay, long excerpts from that essay in one of the biographies, Adams. I forget the title of the book, but this is one of the standard major 1,000-page biographies on Churchill, and it's worth looking up. Thank you.
Thank you, Kishan. I think the questions are really very interesting and very probing. And I'm glad to see that our audience appears to be really fully engaged. Now, there's one more question from Ayesha Sayed. And she says, agents of empires are only identified in retrospect. Meanwhile, the empire has evolved into a new empire today. Its compradors and systems very much in place, albeit under new facades. What are the effectees, i.e. the masses, to do in this tussle between the manipulators and the manipulatees?
I'm not a great expert on history. I'm not a historian. But it would seem to me that in asking that question, you offer perhaps a somewhat Marxist interpretation of history. Well, I'm not a Marxist, and I don't understand very much this kind of subtle, deep thinking analysis. I don't see the world with the kind of eyes that you seem to apply in looking at the world. So let me pass on that question and simply say that this whole agent business, this whole agency business, which is very much an IR theory construct, to me is a bit of a fraud, really. I mean, why the hell do we talk of agency? Why not simply say leaders who were in power who took decisions? I say this because we had a discussion in another group, the Argumentative Indians, on the Great Indian Famine, in which two great scholars put forward the view that Churchill had no agency in relation to what happened in the Bengal famine, that all the blame lies at the door of the governor of Bengal, who was responsible for the famine. But hell, the famine was also in Assam and Bihar and Odisha, and that governor was not in charge over there. And the fact is, as Manu said in the very first question, asked in the first question, famines had taken place in India time and again. And they'd been managed reasonably well. The Indian civil service was a brilliant organizer of management of British India. Why did the ICS utterly fail in the case of the Great Indian Famine? It failed because responsibility was handed over to the army, which destroyed the personal food stocks of farmers in order to create in order to deny potential Japanese aggressors into eastern India from having access to stocks of food. Now, this was a product of the war. So the famine became a monstrous event because of the war. But it was not managed the way it should have been, because Linlithgow was stupid enough not to make a single visit to the affected region. I mean, imagine the Viceroy between 42 and September 44, when he handed over power to Viceroy Wavell, did not make a single visit to the affected region. Other famines had been managed rather well by the Indian Civil Service and the British and Indian administrators. So, listen, I've gone on for too long in this. My apologies, but I frankly don't even begin to understand Marxist thinking and Marxist interpretation of history. But I wish you well.
Thank you, Krishan. Now, there are no more questions in the chat. So before I come to my final question, I'm going to open it for a minute if in the raise hand box. Though Krishan, I know you said this, but...
No, please go ahead, please.
In case someone has a thought right now, I don't want to deny them that opportunity. So if anyone has a question, please raise your hand. And Sugandha, please guide me if I miss the raised hand anywhere, and then I can give them a chance. And otherwise, I will move on to my last question. So I'm just going to wait for a little while until
I think there is... I think Professor Mohanty has a question.
So we also have one more question in the chat box, which has come from our YouTube channel.
From a YouTube channel? Let me go to the chat box then. Yes. Oh, I can't see it on my screen.
Manu Mohanty has a question. Yes, please.
Manu, can you go ahead? Please unmute yourself.
Now, Krishan, firstly, I think there are very, very important issues you have raised. I want to compliment you really about this contribution. Now, I didn't mean to suggest that the earlier families were well managed. In fact, they always had a pattern, and the pattern had an ugly climax in this Bengal famine case. So that is one. But I had two questions which were quite independent, really. The first question was whether you can take Churchill as a phenomenon or as an exceptional, strong leader who steered history. A historical phenomenon represented by a strong leader. I would like to like you to sort of attempt a formulation on that.
Okay.
Please.
Manu, that's a very tough issue, really. I mean, it really goes back again, does it not, to the issue. Do leaders matter, or do leaders represent a movement of the time? And it is really the times, the circumstances, the ethos of those days that guides guides events. I still believe that leaders do matter. Leaders shape events through their own actions. And the transfer of power in India is a splendid example. If Churchill had won the August 1945 election, he would not have done what Attlee did, which was to announce in the speech from the throne at the outset that Britain is leaving India, and produced a hasty departure from India. I don't think Churchill would ever have done that. And you know, Churchill, at the end of his life, and that end phase of Churchill's life has probably not been studied terribly well. I use in the final chapter of my book as the epigram, the words he is supposed to have uttered to his daughter, that I achieved so much to achieve so little. And I think the thing that rankled with him all the time was that he could not hold the empire together. In 1953, at the Bermuda Conference with the American and the American president and the French prime minister, he said that these countries are going to regret the loss of the guiding hand of the Western powers. I mean, he was still convinced that leaving India, leaving British India, would leave the two entities, Pakistan and India, rudderless and very difficult to govern. I think both India and Pakistan showed that we could govern ourselves. And we took charge of the two great immediate post-partition tragic events, the slaughter, the uprooting, the massive upheaval of the refugees and the movements of people, 15, 20 million people who moved from one country to the other, and the Kashmir War. And in our own way, we managed this. And we went on with the process of governance. So, Manu, I would say, for me at least, leaders do matter.
Thank you, Kishan. I just see a question has come in. Ayesha Syed again. Foregoing the effort to make my query palatable, if it may be assumed that the leaders at the forefront of the partition from all sides, India, Pakistan, Bengal, made a wrong decision, what are the possibilities of emancipatory measures for undoing the wrong that has been done?
Okay, that's a real googly. Look, first, I don't know, I don't share your view that in terms of what was possible and achievable in India, that partition was a mistake. I would respectfully submit for your consideration that partition was perhaps inevitable in the way in which India had been governed since at least the turn of the century, when the communal electorates went into play in 1906. I think that created a divide and rule formula which accentuated the differences between Hindus and Muslims in particular, but also accentuated other communal differences in the body politic of what could have been called British India. Your second question, sir, is even more speculative. I would not dare to respond to it. I have no way to imagine how the events that have already taken place can be undone. Thank you.
Kishan, now I come to my closing question and offer you some chance for a few closing remarks to bring today's session to a close. And that is this, that
So may I have the permission to intervene for just a minute? We have missed one question in the chat box.
Which is that?
This question is from Nishant Sharma, and he has posed the question, which is on our YouTube channel. So the question is from Navdeep. With your permission, can I read it out?
Yeah, please. Sure. My apologies to Mr. Sharma, but please read it. Yes.
Okay. So the question says, how can Churchill be blamed for the Bengal famine when he sent 1 million tons of grain to India between August 1943 to December 1944? His letters to the Prime Minister of Canada shows he requisite grains from Australia rather than from Canada for quicker shipment.
I'm not sure if those facts are correct. They certainly do not figure in the comprehensive study by Madhushri Mukherjee in a book that is titled Churchill's Secret War. And Madhushri is emphatic after painstaking research that Churchill and Churchill's right-hand man, Lord Sherwell, the German-born individual who was in charge of logistics, they consistently denied shipping for food grains. I do not know of 1 million tons of food grains that came into India in 43, 44. I'm afraid those facts need to be checked again, because Madhushri maintains with all seriousness that Churchill, that the formula used by the British government, and not just Churchill, but led by Churchill, the formula was to build up food stocks in Britain for the end of war. So I think we don't agree on the facts here. Maybe you can carry out further research, and I would be delighted if you could present a well-documented refutation, not just of what I've tried to say, but what Madhushri Mukherjee has written. I think that would really have some impact. Thank you.
Thank you, Kishan. Now, let me ask my closing question. Reading the Chapter 5 of your book, which is titled If and Perhaps, which is a kind of somewhat philosophical reflection on the entire book, along with a little what if of what might have happened, I get the feeling that through the process of writing this book, you have touched on some very deep issues, for example, like the question of retribution and apologies and what they serve in the present day for what happened in the past, or indeed about this question that Manu has asked about how much we are creatures of our own individual free will and how much we are driven by present and past circumstances. So let me ask you this question, that in writing this book and thereby departing from your normal track of writing on foreign policy and diplomacy, having ventured into the areas of biography and history in such depth, and writing this book, what are the learnings for you personally?
That is a question that really does engage me a little bit. I think I've realized that writing of history is too important to be left only to historians. It's the same way that we say that economics is much too important to be left to economists, that managing the political economy is in fact better handled by those who are not economists rather than economists. Economists, by the way, don't make terribly effective finance ministers in any country, as far as I know. So an outsider brings perhaps a perspective and asks questions which may not have been asked earlier, or raises connections between events which may not have been noticed earlier. But I'm being a little presumptuous in suggesting this, because after all, managing the affairs of any state, managing the affairs of any large or small body of people is ultimately about leadership. It is ultimately about which direction that entity goes, moves towards. There are those who feel that there is an inexorable movement of historical currents and that individuals don't matter. I think that is nonsense, frankly, but that's only a personal view. Equally, leaders are made by events. So leaders may guide events, but leaders are also shaped by events. And that's the simplest way of looking at it is they would not be leaders if a movement did not exist of which supported them and made them leaders. You can't be a leader just because you say I'm a leader. How do you legitimize leadership? Through support. And support means broad-based movement of the nation, of the political entity over which you are the external face, the visible manifestation of that state. So what I really learned is that more than anything else, we need to go back to sources when we study. And I, for a number of reasons, this does not happen sufficiently in our country. It does not happen because researchers simply don't have access to resources. Very, very few are lucky enough to be able to go to libraries and archives in order to get hold of documents. And of course, that presupposes that you have archives where documents are held, respected, and treasured. In India, honestly, we have no real archives movement. This is what amazed me through my experience at Churchill Archives, but then later also at the Woodrow Wilson Center, where I also had a two-month short fellowship, very profitable for me, in the sense that unless we capture historical events in their original material, how are we going to remember history? You know, for one thing, very few Indians write diaries of events as they occur. Officials, leaders, business leaders, and other personalities. And we're too busy. So we write a memoir in our autumn years. And these memoirs, sadly, not because of deliberate intent, but these memoirs are very, very selective in what they actually capture. Churchill Archives. You know, Churchill Archives today holds collections from some 200, 300 personalities of all kinds. One of the most recent that they have acquired are the complete papers of Viceroy Wavell, They acquired them a few months ago, and those papers are being processed, and they will be available at Churchill Archives perhaps in 12 months' time. Now, one does not have to physically go to Churchill Archives. One is able to access all of Churchill Archives papers online, but there is a price to be paid. It's not cheap. It's, I think, somewhere in the region of 30,000 rupees a year. But institutions, maybe there is another pricing policy for institutions, they should be able to afford this. But more than that, we should have our own archives movement. We have the national archives. The condition in which those papers are kept is not exactly brilliant. You know that William Dalrymple wrote his book, The Last Mughal, going through documents of 1857, 58, and 59, which were lying in gunny bags in the National Archives basement. And nobody had opened those gunny bags since those bags had been closed at the end of the national uprising of 1857. And we have no place where anybody goes and deposits their personal papers. So personal papers are held by individuals and they will disappear when those individuals disappear or their successors say that we don't want to give public access to our papers. So there are any number of collections of personal papers which are held individually and nobody knows how to access these because we don't have an archives movement. Now, I'm not a, what shall I say, I'm not a salesman for Churchill Archives, but I have to tell you, I was amazed at the amount of help I received from the staff of the archives. Mind you, they did give me a two-month archives by fellowship at Churchill College. And I was helped to an extraordinary degree by Churchill Archives, by its director and by his staff in removing errors and stupid comments from my book. And they were kind enough to say that this cannot be supported, that this particular document you have used is suspect. And their purpose, I said, why are you doing all this for me? I mean, I'm not paying you anything for this. They said, no, this is part of our job. This is how we support researchers. Is there anybody, any entity in India that has the resources for this? Even the Nehru Library, which is probably the best single location for archival collections in India. We don't provide archival services. We may have the documents and we guard them zealously, carefully. That's very good. But why don't we have 5, 10, 20 more archives across India? After all, documents are everywhere. And we need those documents. Researchers need those documents. Without that, so what I learned, probably the biggest lesson in writing this book was, you have to go to documents. You have to base yourself on solid material. That doesn't mean books are not important. Books are important. But books also give you access to the actual references where the material was lifted from, where a citation came from. That means lots and lots of detective work in libraries and in archival collections. We don't do that. Why we don't do it? This is part of a much, much bigger question. Friends like Manoranjan Mohanty and Patricia Oberoi and so many others who are present in this conversation or those that are aware of the state of academic study in India should reflect on this a little bit. How do we help young researchers to take their studies, to take their analysis to another level. And it's no secret that rather few Indians build an international reputation as scholars. A part of the reason is the West is always very much oriented and interested in itself. But it's also that the quality of our scholarship needs to improve. We have the finest minds in the world, of course. But the finest minds also need the tools. And the tools are documents, are the hard material with which you can carry out analysis. So if a humble effort like mine, which is full of defects, I mean, I discover every day there are things that I should have done, things that I should have read more carefully, which I failed to do. That's my own personal limitation. But we have to make that effort. And in making that effort, we will improve our own research and our own analysis. And at the end of the day, history is all about looking at events with new eyes wherever it is possible. My deep thanks to the Institute of Chinese Studies for giving me an opportunity to present some views, and to you personally, Ravi, and to Sugandha, and to all my friends at the Institute for supporting this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kishan. I see Sugandha and Subhadeep that there is a comment by Mr. Navdeep on the chat. There's no time to go into that now, but I would be grateful if you can pass on that comment, which contains some references that he has unearthed from the Churchill archives, to Ambassador Rana, so that we can take note of that. Now, I think we have come to the close of this session, and I want to commend Ambassador Rana and indeed the entire audience for the nature of this discussion and the depth in which this subject has been examined. It is really extremely revealing, and it reveals the dimensions that is contained, Kishan, in your book, which is actually a very, very slim book. It's only 180 pages without the index and so on, but very cogent and raises so many issues. Just imagine what we have covered in just an hour and a half. It bears further examination. It bears more discussion. And I would urge you, Kishan, and I don't see the publishers on this list in today's chat, but I was very serious when I mentioned that they would possibly do well to publicize this overseas, because I think your largest audience lies there in what Churchill termed the English-speaking peoples. And it would be a nice irony if Churchill's legacy were re-evaluated amongst those very peoples. And I think the time is right and conducive, because people are aware, I think, increasingly, that even great historical personages have defects and faults. And for every great man who does a lot of great things and every great woman, there are many things that they get wrong. And that does not detract from their greatness, but it just makes it more human and more believable for the rest of us. And I think this is a very powerful message that can be conveyed through your book. So having said that, let me once again thank you. And I look forward to your 13th, 14th and more volumes to come. And knowing you, it will be on something quite different. But please keep going. And my thanks to the Institute of Chinese Studies and all our audience for their support and attention. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you, sir. With this, we would wrap this riveting session. And I would like to thank both the panelists for giving us the precious time. The video for today's discussion will be available on our ICS YouTube platform. We would like to welcome everybody for our next Wednesday seminar. Information related to which will be available on our ICS website, or you could subscribe to our newsletters for the regular updates. Thank you.
Thank you.